Law Focus Podcast. Bringing you the facts, handing you your rights. This is Law Focus.
Good evening to all our listeners and welcome to Law Focus on Bio FM 88.1. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Thabo Mahapi and I'm going to be your host for tonight. As we welcome the new month of October, we're glad and appreciate that we're still able to give you content and information that's relevant to your lives. Now, for those of you who are joining us, just a reminder that Law Focus aims to deal with issues relating to legal matters. Tonight's show is one of our monthly profile shows where we feature an individual who is within the legal profession and we get to talk to them about the various aspects that they have encountered while trying to achieve their dreams within the legal profession. We're always here to inform you about your legal rights, as well as explore various topics that are related to the law. Tonight, we hope you enjoy the show, as we'll be in conversation with Nontandla Payne. She's a candidate attorney, and she's also living with a physical disability called Blount's tibia vera. But first things first, let's take a look at our show's social media, where you can find us. That is Twitter, at VowFM, using the hashtag LawFocus. On Facebook, we're VowFM. And for podcasts, you can visit vits.journalism.co.za/law or the Vits Radio Academy page on Iono. And we are also available on Spotify now. Now, let's get started with the first feature of our show, which are the legal hotspots. Let's have a look at our hottest legal stories of the week.
Rounding up all the top stories of the week is Legal Hotspots.
A Dane Fern man who owes the city power 463,000 rand is arrested for bribery. A 50-year-old Dane Fern resident was arrested after he gave police and city technicians 1,500 to reconnect the power to his house. According to the Four Ways Review, the Joburg Metro Police Department undercover unit arrested him during a sting operation last week. Now, the arrest follows after the suspect tried to bribe city power technicians to reconnect him after his cutoff from the power grid. According to City Power, he owes the power utility more than 463,000 rand. And, you know, nowadays we are dealing with a lot of theft, and that's going to be in the news quite a bit. Three Durban cops to appear in court following their arrest for alleged theft of 2.2 million rand. Three police officers aged between 38 and 49 years were arrested for the alleged theft of 2.2 million rand. It's in a bogus search and seizure operation. The Citizen newspaper reported that two of the officers are from the Durban Canine Unit and one is from the Pinetown Crime Intelligence. Now, according to police spokesman Katlego Mogale, in April last year, a warrant officer, three sergeants and a civilian allegedly visited the complainant's house to conduct what they termed a search and seizure operation of an illegal firearm. Now, while these people were searching the premises, the suspects allegedly came across two cardboard boxes and a safe containing 2.2 million rand. They seized the cash without providing any documentation for that and also without saying where the money was going to be taken. The complaint naturally opened a case of theft and the matter was referred to the Hawks Serious Corruption Investigation Unit. The five people were successfully linked to the crime, and the two others who are not yet arrested are still at large. The police say all of them will face charges of theft or alternatively armed robbery. Limpopo Municipal Manager appears in court. A Limpopo Municipal Manager is among four prominent municipal employees who appeared before the Polokwane Magistrates Court on Monday for allegedly stealing 4.8 million rand. Now, this is also according to the Citizen. The money was paid for an agricultural tender, which was illegally awarded to the municipal manager's wife. This money was allegedly embezzled by the manager and his cronies between the financial years of 2015 and 2016. The Directorate for Priority Crimes, the Hawks, arrested the municipal manager on Friday following investigations into allegations that he conspired with signatories at the Makgate, the community property association, irregularly award that tender. Three suspects aged between 51 years and 70 years old were arrested over the weekend, and this all related to that tender. The three include a former member of parliament, a former chairperson of Mokgato Community Property Association, and a bank employee. It's amazing. Sometimes we think that the youth in this country are outrageous. In this situation, we have people who are aged 51 to 70 dealing with this kind of stuff. And they all hold important positions. Sure. But let's see how that story develops. And one of the biggest stories of the week so far has been seven accused in the 255 million rand asbestos corruption case are released on bail. The Bloemfontein Magistrates Court granted bail, and it ranged from 50,000 to 500,000 in the high-profile Free State asbestos corruption case. Now, according to IOL, the seven accused were arrested by the Hawks this week. Six suspects were arrested in Gauteng and the Free State, and the seventh one was arrested in KZN after he handed himself over on Thursday afternoon. The seven accused are as follows: Ntomozi Mokesi, Masumola John Matlakala, Edwin Sodi, Silo Hatebe, Khotso Abel Manike, Tabane Zulu, and Matawana Mlamleli. Hope I got those all right. 47-year-old businessman Edwin Sodi is the owner of Blackhead Consulting, and they've been in the news quite a bit recently. Blackhead Consulting scored millions in contracts from the Free State Human Settlements Department, and he was released on 500,000 rand bail. So the offense is really serious. While the following accused were released on about 100,000 rand bail, they were the 63-year-old former Mangaung Municipal Mayor Matawana Mlamleli, and also the former MEC for the Free State Department of Human Settlements, Ntomozi Mokesi. He's also former head of the Free State Human Settlements Department. 57-year-old Siloga Debo is a businessman from Four Ways. 53-year-old Wiseman Zulu, a former Director General of the National Department of Human Settlements. The other two suspects were released on 50,000 rand bail, and that's Matlakala, a supply chain manager at the Human Settlements Directorship, and 33-year-old Abel Manika, businessman from Club View in Pretoria. Now, they all face fraud, theft, corruption, money laundering charges, as well as contravention of the asbestos regulations, and of course, contravention of the prevention of organized crime. The NPSA is expected to make even more arrests, and all of the accused are expected back in court on November the 11th.
Rounding up all the top stories of the week, it's Legal Hotspots. Law Focus, handing you your rights.
Welcome back to Law Focus on BioFM 88.1. If you've just joined us, tonight we're profiling a young, dynamic, and very resilient young woman. And she's a candidate attorney. She's also living with a physical disability. The name of the disability, I think, is Blount Tibia Vera. We're joined by Nontlantla Payne, and she's going to talk to us tonight about her journey in the legal fraternity and some of the challenges that she's experienced both as a woman and as a person living with a disability. Now, to give you a bit of background about Nontlantla, she was once part of SABC's Reality Educational and Leadership Program. The name of that program, I think, was One Day Leader, and she ended up in the top 20. And she was also under consideration for the top six in the competition in 2017. She's a member of the Women in Mining Committee, and that was the period of 2018 to 2019 at Anglo American Platinum. And she's very versatile. She gave back to her fellow students by being a tutor at the Wits University School of Law, where she was a tutor in constitutional law. She enjoys reading, watching TV, shopping, and spending quality time. Now, originally from Johannesburg, going up here, but having traveled, quite extensively in her childhood between here and Natal and other places. But she comes from a large family, passionate about life, and always ready to conquer whatever throws at her. Good evening, Nontlantla. Thank you for joining us tonight. Welcome to Law Focus.
Good evening, Tepo. Thank you so much for having me today.
Could you tell us a bit about who you are? What's your background? Where do you come from? Where did you go to school? Who are you?
Okay, so my name is Nontlantla Payne. I was born on the 10th of March, 1992, born and bred in Johannesburg. And I'm the only child between my mom and dad. But if you look at the fact that they had three children from previous relationships, you could technically say I'm the last born of the family. But, you know, because my mom passed away, at you know, I had to live in Pietermaritzburg at some point, and then came back to Johannesburg. Pretty much a very, you could say, an unstable life. I went to different schools. In fact, I can't even remember all of them because I changed schools so many times because of, you know, different reasons in terms of moving between provinces. So basically, that's who I am. I live in Johannesburg now, and yeah, I'm a candidate attorney.
At some stage, there was an informal adoption in your life as well, wasn't it?
Yes. So when my mom passed away when I was in grade 8, and then I went to grade 9 and I went to Pietermaritzburg. So my mom's boss decided to informally adopt me, and she took care of me for a year and some bit, and then she got sick. And so a lot of the money was going into her medical fees, and at some point she could not continue helping me with schooling because I was in the boarding school at some point, so she couldn't help me with that. So then had to move, you know, back home in Pietermaritzburg. And then, yeah, continued looking for school then. But I was staying at home for some time, but went back at some point again.
You know, so it's been a long journey to get to the point where you are now a candidate attorney. But what made you embark on this particular profession? What made you choose law?
So, look, I didn't necessarily choose to study law. First, when I applied at UKZN at the Pietermaritzburg campus, and I applied for geological sciences. I got rejected for that course, mainly because I didn't do physical sciences. I then asked everyone else, including the person I call my husband now, to say, look, so which other course do you think I should do? You know, at some point, everyone thought I should be a politician. You know, I wanted to be a politician, and everybody saw me in parliament. And I thought, you know, I wasn't quite certain if it was as a noble of a profession. So I thought, okay, maybe let's try, you know, law, and then use my law degree to get into the political space. So it was by chance. But I think when I went to WITS, then law became a choice because then I wanted to use it as a tool to help me find ways to problem solve. So that's what it was then at some point.
Okay, so you want to go into politics and you want to sharpen your skills in here in the legal profession before you... Hey!
Okay. Not anymore, Trevor. No, oh. I'm fine where I am.
You're fine, yeah.
No, I'm completely happy where I am.
The relationship between attorneys and politicians is a very strong one, Shem.
I wanted to be a Chef Khateb at some point because I know, you know, he has a law degree, and I was like, maybe, you know, you can do both, you know, have a law degree and be into politics, but no, not so much anymore. I'm not keen anymore.
A huge number of prime ministers and presidents are former lawyers.
Yes. I mean, you know, it's telling, and, you know, I could just be in the right profession. But yeah, no, it's fine. So I'm okay. I'm comfortable where I am at the moment.
So, you know, yeah. I often get, you know, asked about, you know, what does it entail to be a candidate attorney? And, you know, because you see it on Suits, you see it on all sorts of programs where it's really nice and exciting and sexy, and you have the last word, and you're in court, and, you know, everything is, you know, perfectly timed. What is it actually like to be a candidate attorney? What does your job entail?
Okay. Hi, sorry. To be a candidate requires a lot of you, to be honest. There's the physical aspect, the long hours. The early mornings, the late hours, the quantity of work, and, you know, it could be admin based, which at some point, you know, you print a whole lot of files, you scan, you know, you do a lot of admin, a lot of is required of you, and a lot of humility is required of you, because I think it's very easy to you know, to come from a VIS university with a law degree and think, oh, I'm not going to print that. It's so beneath. I didn't study for this.
I didn't study 4 years to...
I didn't study 4 years to print and scan papers. But I think it's so much also... Exact passion. You see, you know your stuff and paginating and itemizing and all of that. But you know, you come to understand that, you know, every job has its, you know, pros and cons, and the certain things might not necessarily be printing, but you know, every job comes with that thing that you just don't care to do, right? Yeah. But I guess it's not necessarily about the act of scanning and printing, it's about the principle behind it. You know, being disciplined enough to go to work, to show up every other day, and do what is expected of you. So it's character building more than not. It's learning to deal with different personalities, you know, and understanding yourself a bit more, and understanding what, you know, the lay of the land looks like, and certain things, you know, that might seem minute but are equally as important as the person who's making this more strategic move, in terms of, you know, what next to do.
So the work of a candidate attorney isn't always that sexy, I suppose, you know.
Not sexy at all.
Is there times where you do get some intellectually, you know, stimulating and challenging work? Mm-hmm. And what's that like?
Yeah. So you know, one thing I learned is that you almost have to earn your ability, or you need to earn the opportunity to be given intellectually stimulating work. So let me make an example. So if, for instance, if I'm able to collate a file and I look at the smallest detail in terms of, I make sure all the pages are one-sided, they're punched, and I make sure that all the pages are in order, there's nothing out of order, everything, you know, basically the file tells the story. That gives the person who has the ability to give you more substantive work an indicator that you have something called, for instance, attention to detail. So then that person thinks that, okay, so if she can, you know, file so well, I can only but imagine if we give her more substantive work, that person would be able to apply themselves, you know, and take it seriously. So it's and I think that's the funny part about it, is that we all start with the more admin stuff, but also all of that, how you show up and how you carry yourself when you're doing those administrative tasks, is very telling of the kind of person that you're working with. And you'd be very surprised that people are actually looking and watching you, you know, as you do, you know, stuff that you would think is below your pay grade. So it's you do get a chance to be able to prove yourself, but also there's an understanding that you don't know much, in fact. Yeah. But I guess it's about seeing if you're able to be resourceful enough and apply yourself and be creative at times. You might not know the legally correct way of doing things, but it's about seeing how best you try and apply yourself. So you do get an opportunity like that, and when you do, you try and shine, basically.
Mm-hmm. But ultimately, when you leave a varsity, you know, mm-hmm. you're not an attorney. You have a law degree and you have a good understanding of the law, but how it comes out in practice, you don't know that yet. You have to go through becoming a candidate or a pupil or whatever it is you want, or a corporate attorney or whatever the case may be. Well, it's a translate.
Yeah, you know nothing, basically.
You don't take it. That's what you're doing.
Yeah, that's all you know, academia.
I mean, turning a little bit more towards you and this physical condition, I think it's called Blount's tibia vera, mm-hmm. if I'm correct mm-hmm. in my pronunciation.
Correct, yeah.
I don't know what it is. Do you mind telling our listeners more or less what it is? Because it sounds Latin mixed with German.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not meant to be English. So Blount, so others might even call it Blount's disease for short. But Blount's tibiovera, it's the proper medical term for it. So it's a form of physical disability, and it affects the lower limbs of your legs. So from your knees to your ankles, you there's some sort of bone deformity. There's no particular reason as to what might have caused it. I think at some point before I did my research, I thought my mom didn't drink a lot of milk, you know, for calcium. And I thought, okay, that could be the reason, you know. Other people think, oh, you know, you were hit by a car and whatnot. But I think, look, Blount's is something that is, it's a type of disability everyone knows. So I know around the Black community, they would refer to it as amagwegwe, very loosely, but it's the exact same thing. And you know a lot of us Black people don't quite believe that that could be a disability, because we have a lot of people that we know that have, you know, amagwegwe, and it looks very sexy. So it's a type of disability that requires a bit of management here and there, but you could say there's nothing I can't do for myself. I can even drive a car. There's nothing I can't do. Yeah.
So in the colloquial term, sometimes people refer to it as brackets. Hey.
Yes. Yeah, so it's the exact same thing, but they are, I guess, you know.
It varies.
I mean, the gravity of the brackets and how wide they are. So in my instance, it really is. I have been diagnosed. It's a medical disability. Yeah.
If you've just joined us, we're in conversation with Nontantla Payne. She's a candidate attorney. She's living in Johannesburg, doing her articles, having walked a relatively long road to get here, and also living with a disability of Blount's tibiovera. So we're talking to her just to get an idea of what it's like to be a candidate attorney now, today, in Johannesburg, in a larger firm, and the challenges that can bring forth. Now, Nontantla, your road to becoming, you know, a candidate attorney is perhaps a little bit different from others. You know, you've worn a number of hats, let me put it like that. And one of those was working in the mining industry at some stage. Now, how did you come about that you chose to work in the mining industry? And what were your duties there? I mean, you weren't going down the mines, were you?
So how it came about is that I knew very early on when I was in university that I wasn't quite sure about practice. I think obviously because of other people's experiences, but I knew there was something nicer, you know, that I gravitated towards in mining. I don't know if the fact that it was male dominated was an attraction for me initially. And also I just, you know, was interested to hear someone saying, oh, I'm doing mining law. And I was like, who would have thought? Here we are thinking there's only criminal law, civil. You're like, there's something else called mining law, you know? And I was like, that sounds interesting. You know, really, it was just that. But I didn't think much about it. And I wasn't quite certain how I would get into that space. So you know how when you would have career fairs at university and people would only go there just for the freebies. Oh, no, I actually went there to go ask questions for real. I wouldn't go as much to the law career fairs, but I would go to the general career fairs where I'd go to the companies and see if they would, you know, accept law graduates and what opportunities existed in those spaces. And then, you know, I think at some point I got to understand that I have a natural attraction for the extractive industry. So it could be extracting minerals, it could be extracting Anything, you know, whether it's oil, anything that removes out of the earth, that removes something of substance from the earth, was something that I just found very interesting, only to find out that at Anglo-American, they have this graduate program, which they called BLAST then, but now they call it the Anglo-American Graduate Program. And basically they accept different kinds of students from different disciplines. And, you know, the program was, you know, 4 years in the graduate program and an international rotation, you know, within the 4 years. And the great thing about us law, you know, law students and accounting students, they give you the opportunity to go do your articles, and then you come back into the business. So in my first year, when I started in the graduate program, I you know, I had a very strong liking to environmental law. So they put me in the, you know, you could say it's a discipline somewhat of environmental law. They put me in the permitting team, you know, where you would look at different ways of, you know, processing and systems and how to manage different licenses, you know, from the different sites, from the different mining sites. A lot of my job at that point in time entailed traveling a lot to these mines, but not necessarily going underground. It was just doing the groundwork and figuring out, so what kind of permits do you have? I didn't even know there was a, you know, music permit. I was so surprised. And you learn all these, you know, other permits besides the mining and the prospecting licenses that you know of. So I did that for a year and some bit, and then I went directly into group legal, because I think, you know, sometimes we tend to forget that even Anglo-American, as much as it is a mining company, it's also business. So I went into the legal team of Anglo-American, and there, you know, I was there for roughly 10 months. And then my boss then, she said, you know, if you want to see your career accelerate a bit more, it would be more beneficial for you to be admitted. And basically, I am at Weber Wenzel now, but I'm actually a secondee, so I'm still employed by Anglo-American. So after my you could say my articles of clerkship, I go back into the business, because that is the agreement in terms of the contract.
Right, I see.
Yeah.
You studied at WITS, is that correct?
Correct.
And at your time there, you know, the WITS, the world famous, although it's not quite as good as Tux, I can tell you that. No. Tux,
yeah, you all say that. It's fine. It's okay. We'll give you that. It's okay.
But during your days at WITS, you were also a tutor.
Yeah.
What did you tutor exactly? And and was the experience a good one? You know, were the students encouraging in terms of what they were putting out, their dedication to their work? People complain so much about millennials. What was your experience as a millennial tutoring other millennials?
So I tutored constitutional law, structures of government. I became a head tutor also. I don't know how I became a tutor. Honestly,
found yourself standing with the textbook one day.
I applied for it, but I didn't think they would at any point, you know, choose me to become a tutor. But to be honest, I enjoyed it so much that I did it for 2 years. Of my university career. I didn't struggle, to be honest, when it came to tutoring, because I tend to create an energy that is, that allows millennials to be millennials, you know. I didn't, you know, I wasn't as strict to say I need to have seen your answers jotted down. I was actually more interested about the engagements that would have on a more personal level. Because sometimes, you know, I would, you know, make sure that I cover the basis, the syllabus as expected. But at some point you want to try and stimulate thinking besides the textbook, you know, and stimulate thinking of in terms of what you know to exist out there and push a bit of, you know, boundaries and thinking. And it was just nice to push boundaries, because it's so odd, but you'd be surprised that even millennials, and because of law become conservative at some point. And, you know, when you start questioning certain things, they look at you as if you're betraying, you know, or you're betraying the legal space. And my gosh, I've been taught, you know, this for so many years. And here you are coming to tell me that what I've been taught and what I think to know might not be the correct kind of thinking.
They think you're being subversive, I'm saying.
Yeah, but also I know myself to be very, what do you call it? It's not rebellion per se, but I like to put that. So let's take it a notch further and let's think about this a bit more.
Why have we always done it this way?
Yes, you know, and actually question, you know, and it's like, you know, even if you're a Christian, you also need to, as a Christian, question certain things, just to better enhance your Christianity or what you think you believe in, right? It's not for the next person, it's for you to fully understand what you're convicted in. So I guess it was just trying to push the envelope and see, you know, so how far can we take this? And also I'm like, also learn how to better cultivate, you know, your stance, because someone else might very well, you know, challenge what you think is correct and proper, you know. So I think I found it very interesting, to be honest. All my classes were very exciting. They were always full. I had people coming to my classes. You know, I'm sorry, other tutors, but really, they were coming to my classes. They would either skip other classes and come to mine. And it was fun. And, you know, I would say, you know, get comfortable, sit however you want to sit. It's really not that deep. It's not, that's not the issue here. And it was just nice to have people just randomly talk. I mean, obviously be respectful, but just, you know, if a thought comes into mind, just speak it out and just say it and be comfortable. And that's what you want to build. You want to build confidence, right? Confidence and respectfulness. Because these are fellow professionals that are also going out into the world. So you feel partly responsible, you know, for almost what comes out of that class, in as much as they're also responsible for their learning, but you're also there to cultivate a bit of their thinking and understanding of how the world is.
Right.
Yeah.
No, that's true. Yeah. That's true. Now, in this country, we have an epidemic, and I'm not talking about COVID. You know, in the news nowadays, we've had a problem with gender-based violence, abuses, domestic violence, all sorts of things like that. And so many, well, vast majority of the time, it is women and girls who are subject to these things. And I understand that growing up, it wasn't always that easy for you. And perhaps there's been some trauma here and there, you know, as with many South African women. And could you tell us how you got past that, or not past it, through it, how you work through all of that, and what it's done for you now?
I don't know if I actively did anything to get past it, because when my uncle was touching me and fiddling with me, in fact, the family still doesn't know about it till this day until he passed away. They probably don't understand why I refused to go to his funeral. And this happened like a year ago.
Oh, that's true.
I don't know. Yeah, yeah. So I don't know if maybe that's the as wrong as it is, it might have been the comfort that I probably needed to know that he's no longer there. Obviously, that's more physical than it is more emotional. And I think a lot of the other stuff that happened to me when I was younger, my mom and dad were always there for me, and, you know, they allowed me to cry all the time, cried about it a lot of time. But I think, you know, they made me feel and understand that nothing that ever happened to me was because I did or said anything. And people do what they do for whatever reasons, and we should never be accountable for other people's actions and what they choose to do. So I think just having my mom and dad, and I think probably my relationship with my mom and dad, with my dad in particular, because I was very close with my dad, might have actually done maybe indirect healing, because you would have thought that having went through a lot of a lot of sexual, really inappropriate, I don't know if you call them engagements, with, you know, different people, it would make you see men differently. And I think your trust and belief in human changes a bit, because then you see them in a different light. But I think maybe in some weird way, my relationship with my dad, because I was really close with my dad, I think in some weird way it did a bit of healing, because then, you know, you look at your dad and you think, you know what, not every man, you know,
is that way, yeah.
It's like that, you know.
I think what you said there is what your parents told you is very powerful, and it's perhaps a message that isn't said or repeated enough, because whenever somebody, and it's not somebody, whenever a woman in this country, or very often when a woman in this country is subjected to either rape or physical abuse or emotional abuse or whatever the case may be, you still have a portion of the country who will say, what was she wearing? What did she say? What were the things that may take away some of the blame from the person doing the abuse and put it on the person being subjected to the rape, to the, all of that. And actually what your parents said to you is the absolute truth. There is nothing that you, in this situation, did to solicit this kind of thing. And really, there's never anything that the victim does to solicit. Mm. And I wish more people would say that to someone who has to go through that, because it's a very powerful thing. It alleviates a lot of the shame, but we don't say it enough in this country. But I'm glad that your parents recognized that so quickly and didn't even, you know, question around, but did you say, oh, but did you do, but what were you, nothing along those lines, you know?
No. Nothing at all.
Law Focus on Bolfang 88.1 Point of Information.
Now, if you've just joined us, we're in conversation with Nontlahla Payne. We're talking about being a candidate and attorney, living with Blount, as well as being a woman in South Africa and being a legal professional within South Africa. Her story is varied, from growing up in Gauteng and Natal, KZN, as well as living with different families, going through some of the darkest moments in her life, and having some really great triumphs as well. She's now, having been in the mining industry, also prior to that being a tutor, she's at the moment a candidate attorney with one of the larger firms in the country. So we're going to continue the conversation, and I hope that you are getting these little nuggets of wisdom that Nontlahla is dropping for us. Tell us, one of the biggest things that I've noticed about the legal profession is its inability, in my mind, to embrace a woman in general and black women in particular. And you added a disability to that, and it could become an insurmountable mountain that you need to, you know, to summit. What's been your experience in that?
Sure. I guess for me, it's literally three strikes. It really is three strikes. And then you add to that being a millennial in a conservative space also. So I think, sure, a lot still needs to be done, you know. And I think it's great and well to try and have, for instance, you know, people of color or females, even more so persons with different kinds of disabilities. But I think if the spaces are not fully accepting, in a sense that if I sit in a boardroom And if people don't care to listen to me, it does not matter the fact that I'm black and I'm female and I'm part of a board of, say, seven, you know, white people, you know. Inclusion, you know, is more than just having me there as a black female with a disability. It's actually, you know, listening, you know, taking the time to be open-minded and listen to what I have to say.
It sometimes feels as though we've reduced transformation to bean counting. I need this percentage of this, that percentage of that, and therefore I'm transformed.
Yes. And people don't understand that, you know, transformation is more about inclusion. It's more broader than diversity, you know, and it's very easy for diversity to be a thing. We can have 10 white people, 17 black, you know, but inclusion really speaks to how part of an organization do you feel like? Do you feel like you are being counted as part of your other colleagues, you know, and really a lot has to be done, you know, whether it comes to, you know, speaking about mental, you know, illness, you know, and not just the more physical forms of disability, because I think that's easy to sort of try and treat. But, you know, there are different kinds of other disabilities that are not, you're not seen with the naked eye.
In the last few weeks, that's become quite a topic of conversation in the legal fraternity. Yeah. Because interactions in court have been recorded, and they but they're only now becoming an issue.
Yes.
In the past, that person would have simply gotten into trouble, possibly lost their license.
Absolutely.
Yeah, without the legal. I hear you on
So more needs to be done. And I think one of my biggest issues in general with the legal space is that there's a lot of black people at a CA level, but it becomes really tricky when we talk about how many black people are being retained. The amount of black people being retained in these legal professions, you'd be surprised. It is not even proportionate to the amount of black people that are trained as CAs. If you look at partner level, it's not reflective of how many black people have been trained. If you look at senior associate level, you know, it gets even worse. Hence, it makes sense for at a partner level to where you have the ratio, you know, 2:50, you know, and it makes sense because literally as, you know, the ladder goes up, you know, higher, you find that, you know, black people fall by the wayside, you know, and it's not because black people are not intelligent and they're not talented and they're not competent and they're not capable and they don't work as hard enough or they don't sacrifice as much. In fact, you'd find that we sacrifice a bit more, we work a bit more than our white counterparts, but because
where it matters, to prove that we're good enough, I suppose.
Yes, you know, but unfortunately where it really matters, the people who make the decisions in terms of who gets retained at what level, we are not there to be seen, you know, and there's no amount of representation at all. You know, so it's a lot still needs to be done, to be honest. I'm not even going to say we are trying, we are not doing enough. It's not enough.
Because, yeah. I mean, I know you've touched now on the actual attorneys and themselves, but if you look at the type of work that you get, the extremely well-paying work, which is commercial work, bank work,
given
by mines, et cetera, which is huge volumes of work. Well, not sometimes huge volume, but huge value work, let me put it like that.
That often
does not have a black face behind it.
It doesn't. And I think one thing we also came to realize, you know, being at Anglo's, that you would find that the more sexy work, the big transactions, you would not find any black people in those spaces. And obviously, the less substantive quality work you give, you know, to a black person, what are the chances that they would be promoted to partner level? Of course not. My white counterpart, who has all these big transactions under their belt has all that experience is technically more competent than I am because they've handled all these sexy matters, right? And then you find that, you know, black lawyers are shoved in the more in labor, in criminal, you know, where there's
work, I suppose. Yes, oh, important work, yes. but it's equally kind important, of pedestrian.
Yes, yeah. You know, it doesn't attract the big clients with the big bucks, you that's know. Right, yeah. And so you find that's how they channel a lot of black people in these spaces. But because I need to support my family, I'm going to take whatever, you know. So to be honest, I'm extremely grateful and I count myself very privileged to be in a position where I'm able to, you know, find myself, for instance, in a corporate space or do corporate work, because more often than not, SCAs, you know, you are get told to go to a specific discipline. But it's really sad. It shouldn't be the norm. It really shouldn't be. But that's the current reality at the moment.
And seeing more faces like yours, black women on the bench, whether it's the district court, the regional court, the high court, the appeal courts, or even the con court. As a black male, I think I do have a plethora. I can walk virtually into any court, and I will come across a black, either magistrate, senior magistrate, regional magistrate, a justice of the high court, justice of the Supreme Court, or justice of the con court. They will be there. Mm. And I can recognize myself, my ambition, whatever it is, there.
Yeah.
Is that happening for black females?
Do you mean like in the private sector? Or?
Well, in both. Or, you know, on the bench, in positions of authority within the public sphere, or in the commercial space?
Sure. I think it's different in the private sector and in the public sector. I think you'd be surprised once you get into the private sector how there is seemingly a lot of, you know, females. I'm not sure if there's a lot of females where it matters to have them. And you would hope and think that the females that are in spaces or positions of authority would also open up the spaces a bit. But you can also imagine what they've probably had to give up to be, you know, in that position. And I think sometimes we forget that not every female or not every black person is fighting the fight that you want them to fight. Honestly, other black people are there for themselves. And I think that's a reality we also need to come to terms with, that just because there's a black person who's a judge, don't expect them to open up a space for you. They could very well be doing it for themselves and that's it. And they will tell you what they've had to give up. Parts of themselves that had to give up to be in positions and spaces like that. And it's very hard to recognize yourself in people like that. And you have people that do try and open up a space, but you're reminded very quickly how you got to where you got. And it's not because you're not competent, but the powers that be, you know, they pull strings that, you know, you're reminded very quickly that you should be grateful to be where you are. It's very difficult in the private space. I think it's easy for you to find someone that you recognize with or who's a representative or of you in the public space, but not so much in the private space. It's a bit more different and difficult.
Well, I can tell you in the public space, the disrespect can be just as real. It can be just as real. And it's based on nothing. But the fact that you're black and it can come from another black person as well, being slightly undermined, less considered, less respected than your white counterparts. That's the reality that we live within this country. I mean, let's not get too bogged down. The idea is not so much to get too, you know, deep into the problems that we have.
Yeah.
You know, we're just about to to finish. And I'd like to know, perhaps, if you, in 10 years, from a sort of professional point of view, what would you like it to be? Say, well, in these 10 years, this is what I think I can do. It's for yourself, for your company, for your family, whatever the case may be, but from a professional point of view, what is it?
So I'm still literally still in the formative years of my career. I'm not really quite certain what the next 10 years looks like in terms of, let's say, for instance, a position, but I know exactly what I think I want to do in 10 years. You know, I'd like to be in a position where I'm able to show that treating human beings well, whether it's communities we mine in, whether it's our employees that work for us internally in the mining company, it's very possible to balance both profit and also be and contribute to the economy and to the community. You know, I think a lot of, if you look at the history of mining, and you look at the whole issue of land, you know, there's a lot of history, a lot of blood, a lot of sweat that is centered around, you know, mining industry and versus the amount of, you know, you could say money we profit from extracting mineral resources and, you know, in communities we mine in, you know. I'd like to be in a position to show that we can do that even more. We can be able to, you know, make that profit, you know, get the bottom line, but also be able to uplift, you know, even more our communities and people that work internally for the company. I think for me that would be the biggest mandate. I don't think to be rich you would need to just profit by yourself. Yeah. I think it really is possible to actually contribute where it matters, only because it's the fair and the right thing to do. Yeah.
Well, thanks for that. And I think the only way that businesses will survive is actually by doing that. This newfangled idea that greed is good and that compassion is some sort of communist or socialist agenda is the old hat. It's 100 years ago that was still applicable. We don't live in that world anymore. Before we go, I think I will say that millennials, because we've mentioned them a few times, I think are the first generation to truly understand the concept that profits and compassion can actually complement one another. It's not a choice between one or the other. And that's the one thing I think millennials understand very well, extremely well.
Yeah.
And are better at it than other groups. But that was that's a pain. She's a candidate attorney at one of the larger law firms in the country, but has a long and varied career so far, and only at age 28. It's been very interesting talking to her about her life experiences, her challenges, her fears, some of her visions, and perhaps the very real criticisms from the inside of the legal profession that can and should be made, because the only way in which it can change is if people within the profession and outside of it recognize it and tell people that, hang on, this isn't quite right. It's not sitting with us. So Nontanda, thank you very much for joining us. And we really appreciate your input. We appreciate what you've told us. And I hope that the listener as well will be able to take some of what you've said and carry it forward.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Law Focus on Volfan 88.1 Point of Information.
That's it from us tonight. To our guest, Nontanda Payne, thank you once again for sharing your inspiring story with us. It really was very interesting to speak with you, giving us a little bit of insight on what it is to be a candidate attorney in 2020 during COVID and living with a disability. Very insightful. Now to our producer, Refilia Mekwa, a technical producer, Kutwane Sarame, thank you for putting the show together.
for us. And from myself, Tipmap, it's always a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday evening. I hope you enjoy the rest of the evening. Thank you for tuning in. We hope to see you again next week, same time, same place. Good night.
Bringing you the facts, handing you your rights. This is Law Focus. Law Focus Podcast.